Welcome back to NCAA Bracket Busters with Weeds and Mac, a special podcast series from Pod Topics Chattanooga that's being produced in collaboration with thechattanoogan.com. As we shared with our listeners in previous episodes, this limited-run series is focused on exploring all the happenings with the 2023 NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament. NCAA Bracket Busters with Weeds and Mac features Mark Wiedmer, a member of the Tennessee Sports Writers Hall of Fame, and Mac McCarthy, the legendary former men's basketball coach at UT Chattanooga, who led the Mocs to their 1997 appearance in the NCAA Tournament's Sweet 16 round. Here's your host for the podcast, Chattanoogan.com sports columnist Mark Wiedmer.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Mark Wiedmer, and we're here to record the final installment of Chattanooga.com's podcast, Bracket Busters with Mac and Weeds. We'll just get started, Mac. It's over now. Both the men's and women's Final Fours are in the book. What are the top two or three memories you think you'll take with you from these two tournaments?
On the men's side, obviously the runs of San Diego State and FAU all the way to the semifinals has to be one of the great stories in Final Four history or NCAA tournament March Madness history. But we had so many great games, classic games along the way, great finishes along the way. I don't know that we got what we wanted in the championship game for sure. That came away a little lacking, and blame UConn for stinking up the show a little bit by playing so well. And they played well the whole tournament, winning every game by, I guess, 13 points or more and just dominating along the way. Pretty good for a four seed. I don't know whether we need to look at how we do those seeds or not. And then I thought the women's tournament was unbelievable too. And you had great stories. Iowa with the best player in the country and Caitlin Clark going against Aaliyah Boston and the best team in the country in South Carolina and Dawn Staley. And then LSU and Virginia Tech in the other semifinal. Two great stories of their own. LSU ends up being the story. But I thought it was one of the better women's tournaments that we've seen, and certainly a great Final Four, and the ratings bore that out.
Mac, the women have always been below the men in TV ratings and so forth, but the momentum that the women will take into next year, especially as long as Caitlin Clark comes back to Iowa, do you see a little bit of a sea change possible here, at least for a few years?
When you think about the men's tournament and the coaches that carried it, from Roy Williams and Cal and Pitino and Krzyzewski and Self, you can go on and name them. And the women are starting to have that on their own side. They've got Dawn Staley. They've got Kim Mulkey, and they've got Ariema still. You've got names that you're starting to recognize on the women's side. And of course, the women's game continues to get better and better. We talked about it off the air a little bit. Caitlin Clark does things that nobody since Taurasi has probably done. And maybe she does some things that Taurasi didn't even do. But I think the women's game has just gotten progressively better. It's gotten more attention. It's demanded that more people pay attention by being a quality game. And I think you're going to see that continue to grow. But I think they caught lightning in a bottle a little bit. They had a great tournament. And the men's tournament didn't have the blue bloods coming down to the final weekend, which we talked about last week, maybe affected the ratings a little bit for them.
Well, and here's another thing, Mac. In the one-and-done era, the transfer portal era, and so forth for the men's game, you're going to probably open the women's season next year with Caitlin Clark still at Iowa, with Angel Reese still at LSU. That brings a lot of interest, I think, to the sport. And as you said, you're with coaches they're familiar with. I could see the women's game actually arriving next year with more anticipation than the men.
The continuity that the women have, because there's no real place for them after they play in college. WNBA, it's grown, it's done better, but they still don't pay enough. Most of the WNBA stars make more money in the quote-unquote offseason overseas than they do playing in the WNBA. And until that changes, especially at the top levels of the women's game, the NIL situation will keep anybody who might think of going to the WNBA early, and by early, I mean maybe even before the fourth year, I think they're going to hang around. I think the stars in the women's game right now can make more with the NIL than they would make in the WNBA as a rookie.
I would think so, too. I know you hear about like a first-round draft choice, a top draft choice in the WNBA makes about 75 to 80 grand their first year. There are a lot of guys in the NBA making that much a game.
I know multiple women's players that have been in the portal or choosing to stay that are easily above 100 and some above 200,000 for their NIL deal.
I would think somebody like Clark could push toward seven figures next year.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it at all.
Mac, you had an array of great points you wanted to discuss earlier today. Why don't we just get into that right now?
First thing that I heard talked about a lot over the last week or so is tournament expansion. That seems to be really getting a lot of play. You've seen some coaches like Dan Hurley came out and said, we shouldn't change anything. 68 worked. 64 was even better. Everything from it fits on a sheet of paper to draw the brackets. But there are a lot of coaches who think that we ought to expand the tournament to include more teams. My questions would be, are there enough quality teams to warrant that? Would it be practical? Is it going to be too many games? Is it logistically something that we could do? And then the biggest question for me is, are we going to get the North Texases and UABs? Are we going to get the Furman from a year ago when Chattanooga upset them in the tournament? Are we going to get them in the tournament? Or are we going to get Clemson and Syracuse and Mississippi State? Are we going to get these Power Five teams that can kind of schedule their way because they've got so many quadrant one opportunities just by being in the league they're in? If we're going to get more mid-majors in, I might be for it. But I'm certainly not for it if we're just going to add more Power Five schools padding their pocketbooks.
A little bit to your point, Mac, what if we just cut back on the high majors and added a few more mid-majors?
Yeah, if we can figure out a way to do that. We have a situation where with the NIT that if you go through your mid-major league and you win that league, one, two, three, four games, maybe you even go undefeated and you get upset in the tournament, it's not right that you're not in the NCAA tournament. I speak a little bit as one of those victims along the way at Chattanooga, but seriously, I think adding some of those teams would add interest to the tournament.
Well, and I think when you look at this past tournament, when you look at a lot of the early upsets, that goes to your point. There are a lot of really good teams out there. And Brian Dutcher brought this up on Sunday in the off-day press conference, that the mid-majors, particularly the higher mid-majors, really deserve to be there more than the also-rans in the Power Fives.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that could be done. But one thing is, I just don't understand, if you've got a losing record in your league, how do you qualify, unless you're the automatic qualifier, how do you get an at-large bid into the NCAA tournament?
I couldn't agree more. You look at Arkansas, which is 8-10 in the SEC. Now, I will say this. I do think there should be an exception every now and then for a team that is playing without one of its best players and its record with that best player, and if that best player is back for the tournament, maybe they get an exception. But let's say with Nick Smith, Arkansas had been and they weren't, but let's say they'd been 7-1 with him and whatever they would have been without him, but he was back for the tournament. I could see letting them in, but I agree with you in general. I think a team with a losing conference record, you're choosing to be in that conference. You're choosing the financial rewards of being in that conference. And if you can't have a winning record in that league, you don't need to go to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and I heard two really good arguments that were both very convincing today that go along with this. One said, we need to eliminate the committee. We need to go all analytics, all net, all KenPom, whatever you want to use. But on the other hand, in the next hour, I hear another argument that says we need more of the eye test. That's why Connecticut ended up where they were. And that's how you ended up with an NC State getting in the tournament and Clemson not getting in. And Clemson beat NC State three times by double digits, all three times.
Well, I agree with kind of both points a little bit, Matt, because even the analytics are somewhat skewed by the people that create them. But I do like the eye test, and I also like the fact something they used to do a lot, and they say they don't do it anymore, and that's your last 10 or 12 games going into the tournament. I mean, that's how you're playing at tournament time. I don't really think, particularly now with the transfer portal, that November should have a huge weight on where you're seated in the tournament.
Yeah, along with that thinking, I have said this all along, kind of contrary to what you're saying, is I think the best measure of the best team in the league is how you do over the course of the season. And that goes against what you're saying. If someone gets hot or someone gets healthy or someone has someone hurt, sometimes that kind of skews my point of view, but I don't understand why mid-major, with what's at stake, if your team can advance, That gives you more money. With all that's at stake money-wise, why wouldn't you want to send your best representative? Why would you want to take a chance on a conference tournament and some upset, which would be a great story, but then they're going to get hammered in the NCAA tournament in the first round?
Well, and Mac, you probably know more about the financial side of this than I do, but would you not, by doing away with conference tournaments, because 85% of them don't really make money, would you be better off just to do away with them, maybe expand the tournament, and then take the early revenue and the TV dollars from those early games and spread it over all the conferences?
Yeah, like we've talked about before, the answer is money. What's the question? So it doesn't matter what the question is. If there's more money, then there's a way to make this happen.
I know that there's the excitement of a team struggling all year, getting hot in the tournament and winning a bid. But as you said, and I've written before, then that takes away a bid a lot of times from the team that deserves to be there. I'm with you on a mid-major level. You need your best team in the tournament.
Yeah, look what Furman did this year. That was another $4 million when they advanced. Of course, by the time you parcel it out over the league share and a double share for Furman and spread it out over the rest of the league, it doesn't have a major impact on your budget. But when you're a low or mid-major, you need every penny you can get.
That's exactly right. It's a problem, but to go back to your point about the whole season, I think a conference game in January should count as much as a conference game in February. What I don't like is you're really penalizing a team for losses in November when they could play a weaker schedule and not have those losses. And you should want a lot of marquee games in November just to appeal to fans. I mean, personally, I wish there were no games before Thanksgiving, but that's long gone and never coming back.
All right, on tournament expansion, are we going to expand it or not?
I hope they don't expand it. For one thing, you're kind of in a window where I think most of the country would prefer to have the tournament over with before the Masters. To greatly expand the tournament or even marginally expand the tournament, unless you do away with conference tournaments, it would be hard to fit those games in.
Well, I've argued against expanding the football playoff, so I'm going to argue against expanding the basketball playoff too.
Well, you got to be consistent. Isn't that what great coaches are, Mac? Aren't great coaches?
You've accused me of being consistent in the past, and I don't think it was a compliment, but yes.
Oh, no. I don't remember ever criticizing your coaching, McCarthy. All right. You had a good list this morning, Mac. Let's move on with that.
All right. Let's talk about Blue Bloods. I'm going to jump in here first. I'm ready to accept Kentucky, Kansas, North Carolina, and Duke. I think we can agree and make those a given, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now, here's my problem. UCLA has won one in the last 50 years. No longer a Blue Blood. Indiana hasn't won one since, whatever, 87. No longer a Blue Blood. I don't know whether we have a limit on Blue Bloods. Can we only have four? Do we need five? Do we need six? Can we have?
Well, whether we need them or not, it's almost impossible now not to consider UConn a Blue Blood.
Okay, let's go with UConn. I'll buy that. Five puts you up there, and they certainly deserve it. Now, the one that's on the fence, what about Villanova?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair argument. They've won three titles with two different coaches. That's always been on the Kentucky side of things and North Carolina. They've won them with multiple coaches. All of Duke's come with one coach, basically. All of UCLA's come with one coach. And I think that makes you a Blue Blood. If you've got multiple coaches who've won in your program, that says a lot about the program over the coach.
And isn't it interesting that everybody we've mentioned, all six of them, their color is blue?
It is interesting.
Yes, different shades of blue, but all of them are the color blue. Now, what does someone have to do to get it? Gonzaga has been consistently in the Final Four. If they win one, do they jump into the Blue Bloods, or they've got to win more than one?
No. I think they're upper class. I don't think they're a Blue Blood.
What about Michigan State?
That's a little more difficult, but they've got two titles. No, I don't think they're a Blue Blood.
A lot of Final Fours.
A lot of Final Fours. An excellent program. I don't know if we could come up with a slightly less haughty title than Blue Bloods, they'd certainly fall in that mix.
All right, we've solved that then. We're going to give them six, right? We're going to go with Villanova and UConn along with the four that we all agree on.
Yeah. I mean, there's no logical way to leave UConn out of that discussion anymore.
All right, now let's talk for a minute about the luckiest man in sports, Jim Nantz. goes from calling the Final Four to calling the Masters in the same week, which might be the best week in all of sports, to be honest. It's certainly in the conversation. But first of all, comments about Nance, and then tell me who you're replacing him with.
Mac, I have spent a good chunk of today on that question. I think seven times I had the blessing to do both in basically a week's time, the Final Four in Augusta. And there's nothing like it. It's an incredible 1-2 punch and just amazing. The names I come up with the most are Rhys Davis and Chris Fowler. I don't think Fowler would be interested in it because he's got football and he's got tennis. He's got Wimbledon every summer. But I could see Davis, particularly with all that's going on with Disney and the ESPN contracts, maybe wanting that job. And I think he would fit in well with that. And then Ernie Johnson, it might be an easier transition for him. He's been there now the last few years anyway with TBS, and he's an excellent studio host.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Ernie Johnson, that's one name that had escaped me, but certainly Rhys and Fowler. The other name that kept popping up in my mind, I'm trying to think of someone who is calm enough to do both of them. But some play-by-play guys are a little more animated, a little more, not passionate, that's not the right word, but just animated is probably the best word. I think of a guy like Mike Tirico would be one of the guys that is more of a regular play-by-play guy than some of the others that I thought might fit into that.
I agree with you on that. I think Tirico could certainly do a good job on it too.
But Nance has been unbelievably good. I like the fact that he doesn't make the event about himself, although he's become a big enough celebrity that sometimes it is in spite of himself, but not really while the broadcast is underway, I don't think. I think he does as good a job as anybody of kind of staying in the background despite getting the job done.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mac. And of course, for him to have been at Augusta as long as he has, you kind of have to be that way because the lords of Augusta National are not going to have somebody be too big a face in the crowd there.
Yeah, I was worried about this subject because I figured that we might meander off path from bracket busting to the green jacket, but we'll get it back on track here. Talk a little bit about, did we see the results of COVID plus the portal plus the NIL in both the women's and the men's tournaments?
Well, I think we did. I mean, you look at Caitlin Clark, grew up in Iowa, always wanted to be a Hawkeye. She's kind of a flashback to the past. But look at Angel Rhys, who started at Maryland and then transferred into LSU. I mean, that whole LSU team, what, Mulkey brought in 10 players, I think, her first year? Yeah.
In their top eight, they had 6 transfers and 2 freshmen.
Right. So to do what they've done, and then at the same time, don't you have that same situation at Kansas State this past year where Tang brought in literally 10 new bodies and they get to a regional final and almost get to the Final Four?
Yeah, you can literally rebuild a roster from zero, which Tang did. South Carolina, a couple transfers. They had a girl from Syracuse and a girl from Georgia Tech, but mostly still kind of homegrown for them. Virginia Tech had a little bit of both. They had several players that had been in the program for 4 years. And Elizabeth Kitley, who was 2-time player of the year in the ACC and an All-American, she has announced she is coming back for her COVID year, which she's got an awful lot of options, including med school waiting on her, as well as possibly the WNBA or playing overseas. And she is choosing to come back. And I can't help but think that NIL had something to do that. But it does seem like all the teams that did well were older teams, and whether they got older because of COVID or whether they got older because of the transfer portal, it didn't seem to matter why they got older, but we had a lot of older teams, and then we're kind of toward the late middle part of this COVID thing. I think we've got 1, maybe 1.5 more years of COVID exceptions coming up.
Mac, I'm just happy to have Kitley back for her podcast.
The Queens of Castle with Elizabeth Kitley and Georgia Amore. It is worth tuning in, to be sure.
I had a column last week about Virginia Tech on the Chattanooga and your tape of the podcast after they'd won the ACC. I had to put some dialogue from that in the column. It was so delightful.
That's great. That's great.
One thing, Mac, as a coach, I don't think coaches who succeed with this get enough credit. Everybody just thinks you go out there and grab 10 bodies. There's a lot of talent in being able to look at the chemistry of your team with these new players and bringing them in. That's a difficult thing to assess, how these new players are going to fit with your current players. And do you think coaches who succeeded with this, like Tang or Mulkey, get enough credit for that?
You and I have had many conversations about recruiting. It's the most inexact science that I know of. And not only that, it's the only thing I know of in life where you can do absolutely everything right. You can outwork the other people. You can do all the extras with the families or the coaches or the agents or the girlfriend or whoever. You can do everything right and still not come away with the young man or young woman coming to your program. It is the hardest thing that I have come across to do. But it's the same thing whether it's a freshman or whether it's somebody in the transfer portal. You have to evaluate, and then you have to recruit them. And then we'll throw the curveball in there. Now you have to have sufficient NIL also.
Yeah, and don't you think the NIL, one, is not only going to become more and more important, but also more difficult in programs, particularly high, mid-major even, where there's just not that much money. Now, UTC, I don't consider a high mid-major by any respect, but Wharton came out, I don't know, in a column I did last summer, the average NIL money for his football program was like $125. You're not going to be able to recruit very well with that.
No, I do think you're going to see more creative things. Cash is one thing, but I think there are other ways to come up with enticements, if you will, to help people, whether it be free rent or free food. I think there are other ways you can do it rather than just cash. These are some talented people at these colleges and universities across the country. I think you'll see them all get involved in the NIL game. They'll just approach it from a different perspective at the very highest levels versus some of the low majors.
Well, wouldn't you think business internships be on the table there? Would that be legal?
100% legal. Yeah. Internships. When you talk to the fundraisers at universities, they all want the cash, right? But they'll all also take what they call gifts in kind. And that can be gifts in terms of actual gifts or services rendered.
Mac, to briefly return to what this podcast was supposed to be about over the last month, where do you put Danny Hurley right now? From a terrific basketball family, but what he was able to do with this program, where do you rank him right now as a coach nationally?
I think what he's done is incredible. UConn, while they have won under Calhoun, they won under Ollie, now they've won under Hurley, they were kind of on the fringe. They didn't belong anywhere. They were sort of in the Big East, and then they went away to the American because of football. Then they went back to the Big East and said, football, you just play as an independent. Good luck with that. Jim Moore's done actually a pretty good job of bringing that program back a little bit, had them bowl eligible a year ago. But considering the instability of UConn and where they belong in the world of college athletics, I think what he has done is really incredible.
And I don't see any doubt that as long as this roster that's eligible to come back comes back, they should be the favorite to repeat.
Yeah, and they've done it a little bit, kind of a grab bag of things. I was watching with particular interest. Nyheim Aline is a guy who started out at Virginia Tech and started early in his career, and then his role kind of diminished, and he transferred to UConn, which I questioned at the time. He wasn't really playing a big role for Virginia Tech on his way out. And then a guy named Tristan Newton, who transferred from East Carolina, played 3 years at East Carolina, and the program really never had a lot of success. And his teammate, Jaden Gardner, went to UVA and started for 2 years, and he went to UConn, and certain nights he was their best player.
Oh, absolutely. I thought he played a huge role, particularly defensively, in both the semifinal and the final.
Yeah, so they kind of did a little bit of portal work, but a little bit of recruiting of the freshmen too. But I agree. I think as long as he's there, they're going to be a contender. Of course, the competition is picking up in the Big East with your guy, Patino, at St. John's. And I think even with the change at Georgetown too, with Coach Cooley going down there, I think the Big East is certainly a force to be reckoned with. I know we have the Power Five in football, but we certainly have a Power Six in basketball.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you look at what the Big East did in the tournament this year, I mean, they could easily have had two teams in the Final Four with Creighton, and then Marquette had such a great run. So, yeah, they absolutely belong in the same discussion, in the same sentence with the Power Five leagues.
Yeah, Xavier was in that mix, too. I think they're going to be hard to handle, and two programs that have been down, St. John's and Georgetown, are absolutely going to get better with the coaching changes.
Yeah, one thing about Slick Rick is he gets a program better and better fast everywhere he goes.
Do you like my comparison of Patino and Mulkey?
Not really. I think he has a little more decorum on the sideline than she does. But yeah, I mean, there are other aspects to him that would be much the same. Let me say, I think one of my biggest problems with what went on in the women's tournament there in the last game or two was I don't mind people being upset when they lose. I don't mind them being ugly when they lose. I hate people who win who are ugly about it. I've always told my own children, winning's its own reward. You won, keep your mouth shut and move on. And that's not where we are. And I mean, you and I brought this up early in this podcast series. It's kind of reflective of the country as a whole, but I'm so sick of the lack of civility a lot of times with these people.
Does that go along with Musselman too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The whole ripping his shirt off. I mean, come on. And he's a guy, let's face it, he comes from a coaching family. His dad's team's behavior at Minnesota was not terribly noble either. I'll never forget the Minnesota-Ohio State brawl and the blood that was on the Ohio State players' faces after that.
Yeah, it was Luke Whitty.
Luke Whitty, the Ohio State center, and then I think, well, Alan Horniak was their guard who was so good. But I think Minnesota had, what, Ron Behagen? Actually, who's a great baseball player?
Dave Winfield.
Yeah, Dave Winfield was on that team. That was one of the ugliest moments in the history of college basketball.
Yeah.
And you could argue some of that was how charged up Musselman got that team.
You will save us, Greg?
Yes. Speaking of Minnesota, of course, I lived up there for about 8 years. A couple things. It was tremendous to see Jim Dutcher make it.
Yes, it was.
It was one of those things where, sad to say, I wasn't sure if he was still around, right? And he was there. He looked good. And speaking of a recruiter, Mac, when you talk about Dutcher, you got George Gervin at Eastern Michigan. Kevin McHale, a homegrown from up on the Iron Range in Bob Dylan country from Hibbing, Minnesota. And then Michael Thompson, who was on that team. Some of those outfits that Jim wore in the 70s were just crazy. The polyester check things.
Could he have given Mulkey a run for her money?
Yeah, I think so. Although, I mean, the outfit she had on, you'd think that Mardi Gras had continued way past Lent. We were talking a little bit before we got rolling about the last 30 years. The top teams, how about your all-tournament team for the last 30 years? Would Leitner be one of those guys? If you had to pick five out of the last 30, Mac, we'll start with you and I'll let Weeds ponder it.
It's really hard because in the last 4 years, you got the one and dones. You got a guy like Carmelo Anthony, who basically won it by himself. You got a guy like Anthony Davis, probably the last one and dones that won a championship. You got a guy like Leitner, who probably went every year that he was there. And you got a guy like Bobby Hurley, who had great success, especially after having a real bad game, maybe as a freshman, I guess. Boy, that's tough. I didn't do very well.
I would certainly put Leitner on there because of the two Final Fours. Wow, trying to think after that.
Ewing would have to be on there, I think.
Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't be 30 years. He won it in 84 and then was runner-up to Villanova in 85. What about a guy like Shane Battier? You look at Duke and they're sprinkled throughout the years. Like in Carolina, do you put Hansborough in there?
Yeah, the guy that played unbelievable for Carolina was the guard, what was his name?
Donald Williams.
Yes.
Now, that Carolina team in 93, they had Montross and George Lynch, Williams. I mean, that was a stacked team. If you look at my Cats, go to 96, and you had Mercer and Tony Delk. That team was loaded. Antoine Walker. You've had some super teams. Trying to pick five guys off those teams is pretty difficult.
Yeah, like Mateen Cleaves had an incredible run.
Mateen Cleaves had an incredible run, and that was 2000. Who was the guard or kind of wing that started off for UConn in 99?
Hamilton.
Yeah, Rip Hamilton, had a great tournament that year. This is fun, but it's hard to try to remember all these players off the top of your head. UConn only, Walker, Kemba Walker, in 2011.
He won the tournament.
Well, won the tournament, and Shabazz Napier wasn't far behind him in 14. But Kemba Walker's tournament in 11, going back to the Big East tournament, which they had to win to get in the NCAA tournament, is the stuff of legend.
Four games in four nights.
Just incredible. He would definitely make my all-Final Four team over the last 30 years.
The ones you've named, even before we brought this up, it all kind of came back to some of those Blue Blood teams or the teams on the fringe of the Blue Bloods, like Cleves at Michigan State. So some consistency with the programs, bringing people in.
How about Gordon Hayward for Butler?
Do you have to have a title to be on the list?
It was 10 when he had the spectacular run and barely missed beating Duke on a half-court shot at the buzzer.
What about Adam Morrison?
Adam Morrison was great for Gonzaga. There have been a lot of tremendous individual efforts. Even Timmy in the year they didn't win and got in the final against Baylor, what a run he had.
The year they didn't win was all of them.
Yeah.
So I want to say this. It's been so much fun to spend this time with you. You guys have been so insightful. It's been so much fun just to be a part of these conversations. And thank you for allowing me to jump in here and there.
Oh, you a huge thank you for sort of keeping us on point.
He's the Ernie Johnson of us.
Well, he is.
That's the highest praise.
Maybe you should replace Nance.
I don't know if I've told Mac this story before, but I'll try to tell it very quickly. Now, we all know Jim Reynolds, and he's a legend. Well, I got hired at WGOW. Gary Mack hired me to be a host of a jazz show. And about 3 weeks after I got hired, Reynolds got laryngitis. One thing I had done in college, I was pretty good doing basketball play-by-play. And it was your first year, Mac. Gary was like, I need somebody to do the game because Jim literally couldn't speak. So I told Gary, I said, listen, I've done a bunch of college basketball at St. Cloud State. And Gary was like, I don't know, man. He goes, you're going to be our jazz guy. I couldn't talk him into it. I don't know if you remember this, but Randy Price ended up doing that game. Who knows what could have been had I done that. But that was one of those ones where I should have lobbied for it. But to be able to have a chance to work with you again, I wanted to ask you this because you've been doing radio. What was it like for you to be doing a national semifinal game for Virginia Tech?
Unbelievable. It was so cool to do it. I've done just enough radio now to feel like I'm decent at it because it's so different from television. 100% different than doing color on television. Color on television, I can tell stories. I can talk while they're going up and down. I can say, well, you saw that. You have to completely change to do the radio. I'm in and out. Don't get to tell stories. But I had a ball. I had an absolute ball doing it. One of the most fun things I've gotten to do.
Cool, because I love doing radio. I love doing the play-by-play radio. And the one thing that I really wish that I had been able to do, not just announce the game, but do the post-game interview with you, and hopefully it would have been a win, so it would have been a pleasant conversation.
Well, there was a pretty good chance. When Jim got the laryngitis, or whatever he had, we were going to Marshall and VMI. So he did the first game at Marshall, but couldn't do the second game. Randy did it at VMI. That was a legendary trip. We went through this huge snowstorm after the game at Marshall, going across the mountains to get to Lexington, Virginia.
And Weeds, that was your first year on the beat, too. And when I first got to town, didn't you and Roy coach one part of the blue-gold game, and then Jack Hodges did the other?
Yes, we did, and Roy and I won. Lord, I think we won by 1 point on a shot by Carlos Jeter.
It took a lot of finagling to get them to win.
It changed my whole view of coaching, how quickly you had to make decisions. Watch a game on TV kind of dumbs it down. I mean, everybody thinks they can coach sitting on their couch, but when you're in those huddles, those timeouts move along pretty quickly.
People are looking for direction too. Want to shift one more gear because you guys brought it up. It is Masters Week. Weeds, what is your most favorite memory of going to Augusta?
Oh, everything about it. I mean, the first year I went, I guess, was 85, and Bernhard Langer won it on a very rainy weekend. I don't know, Greg. Just every one of them I ever went to was just spectacular.
Mac, did you ever get a chance to go?
20-some years in a row. But the first time I went, I actually was an assistant coach at Auburn, and we had a manager whose dad was a member. And he heard Herbert Green, the other assistant, the guy who recruited Barkley, he heard us talking about playing golf and talking about Augusta, and he said, "My dad can get you on. You all can play." Needless to say, we promoted that manager immediately, but we got a date, we got it all set up, and we talked until late in the night about what each of us was going to wear, like a couple of teenagers. We got over there 2 hours before we were supposed to because we were so excited. We didn't have GPS. We had to actually figure it out how long it was going to take us. We got over there, and we played the par 3 course. Who knew from a golf perspective that was going to be the highlight of my day? I shot a little 29 on the par 3 course, and I thought, hey, this is going to be fun. And then we had lunch in the clubhouse, which was just memorable to this day. And then we played the big course, which went about kicking my tail. And actually, Herbert Green, the guy I played with, shot an 80, which was pretty impressive. And I parred one hole. And I was actually a decent golfer. I parred the 18th hole by chipping the ball in. And that was my only par the whole day. I hit some greens in regulation and three-putted, maybe even four-putted. But that's a whole other story. But yeah, that's certainly the most memorable one. But once I started going as a fan, again, nothing's better. If I could pick one sporting event to go to each year, I would pick Augusta.
Did you get the clam chowder in the dining room that day?
No, I want to say it was either pea soup or navy bean, I think.
The dining room is spectacular. The food is just as perfect as you think it would be, but everything on the course is perfect. They wrap the sandwiches in green paper, so if somebody's rude enough to drop it, it's not easily seen.
It was unbelievable. It's really hard to play golf with your mouth hanging open.
I want to ask you guys about your predictions for the Masters.
I'll go out just because my daughter loves him. I'll pick Rory.
I heard a lot of talk today about take Rory and Rahm and Scheffler versus the field. I'm taking the field.
You're taking the field. Okay. We might see a new person wearing the green jacket.
Very possible.
Weeds, any final thoughts?
As I say every year, I wish I could go to sleep right now and wake up in November when all this starts over.
Thank you guys very much. This was fun.
Mac, so great to do this. And Greg, like I said, thanks for sort of keeping us on course.
My pleasure, guys. Let's sign it up and do it again sometime soon.
Thanks for joining us for NCAA Bracket Busters with Weeds and Mac, a special podcast series from Pod Topics Chattanooga, produced in collaboration with thechattanoogan.com.